This podcast is proud to be part of the TalkSport Fan Network. TalkSport. Powered by fans.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
The TalkSport Fan Network is proudly supported by McDelivery, bringing you the food you love. McDelivery brings a top-tier lineup of food right to your door. No matter the result, you'll always be winning with McDelivery. Order now on the McDonald's app and you'll get rewards points delivered too, so that ordering today means some tasty rewards for tomorrow. Only via app at participating restaurants. 18 plus rewards registration required. Points only on menu items, delivery fee and terms apply. See mcdonalds.com.
Welcome back to A Complete History of Manchester United. I'm your host, Wayne Barton, author and producer, several Manchester United books and films. I'm joined, as always, on this journey by the legendary football writer, Paddy Barclay. And, of course, Paddy is the author of this book, which we've been referencing throughout the podcast series to this point, the definitive biography of Sir Matt Busby, the man who made a football club. Course, that's titled the paperback. Not necessarily the title of the hardback, but either edition. I'd get both for your library, that's what I would say, because everyone needs a fuller library. This is actually the first episode after the Busby era, officially speaking, because obviously he was in charge for much of the previous season. Wilf McGuinness is now in charge at Manchester United. We shall debate whether or not that's the actual case. If you're watching this video, please give us a like and subscribe. Join in the conversation in the comment section. You can join in live or on catch-up as well, because we still reply to the comments. If you're listening back on the audio podcast, please be sure to subscribe and give us a review on the platform you're listening on. Okay, Paddy, let's start with this. Wilf McGuinness, he's got the season, he's got the summer in charge to lay down his foundations. From everything that, I mean, you and I both talked to Wilf for in various interviews. We know how much he loves United. Yes. It seemed very much that rather than have radical ideas of what he wanted to do, he was so faithful to what the club had done that he just wanted to continue it, right? That was the idea behind Wolf's manifesto, if you want to say.
Yes. He was, as you say, loyal to the club in an extraordinary way. I mean, his loyalty might be compared to his playing style, you know, fierce. And total. When it was the end, it would be messy for him and for everybody else. But when he took over, as we said in the last episode, it seemed to make sense. It seemed to chime with the times, a young coach in charge, but with the with the sagacity of an aging Busby. When I say aging, 60 years of age, wouldn't appear too young now. It's almost a generation less than I am, as we speak. But we were talking about different times, and we were talking about a man who had survived, I wouldn't say a near-death experience, but an experience worse than that, in the sense that he'd lost sort of the next best thing to children in the Busby Babes, and had to cope with that and the guilt and everything else. So he was probably old before his time. I think in the season we're talking about, 69-70, he actually celebrated his 60th birthday, or just before. So, yeah, he was there in the background, yeah.
Jimmy Murphy as well, we a name that we haven't really talked about since the FA Youth Cup win. Yeah. And we talked about it briefly in the European Cup. Success was prominent in cajoling the players in extra time and comforting the Benfica after extra time. But he's been sort of moved away, not in a sort of direct way by McGuinness. He hasn't intentionally tried to marginalise Jimmy Murphy, but you got to remember that Busby and Murphy were so overpowering to him. Like, they were so imposing their personalities that when he's come into the role, and this is his first fresh season, he's trying to do things his own way, that he's almost not wanting to take on their advice and information because he wants to try and do it his own way. He wants to prove that he can stand on his own two feet. Now, we're going to see in the early weeks how Busby's sort of influence interferes with that in a certain way. But as far as Jimmy Murphy was concerned, Jimmy was almost instantly marginalised, wasn't he? He was sort of like, not in, like saying intentional things, but because he was almost too deferential, McGuinness, and too frightened to ask for this advice, for it to be seen that he was going to undermine him in a certain way, that he was trying desperately to stand on his own two feet with that. So Murphy, he was doing day-to-day stuff around the club, but he was almost instantly sort of transformed into this scouting role where he would go and scout opponents and players.
Yes. He could never have had the relationship with Wilf that he had with Busby, because although, you know, in many people's eyes and in the, you know, you as one of the club's historians, self-appointed historians, but brilliant nonetheless, would argue that Murphy was the equal of Busby, and so their relationship was hand in glove. But so it would be impossible for a young whippersnapper called Wilf McGuinness, even though Jimmy had obviously been fundamental in instilling Murphy-like attitudes in him in his playing career, to have had that kind of relationship. It just could never have worked. So, I mean, when you look back at it with that wisdom of hindsight, you can perhaps see a reason for the beginning of the seeds of Jimmy Murphy's estrangement from the club. Although, as we go through the next few episodes, probably I would guess about five episodes down the line, we will discover the great Jimmy Murphy revival, but that's for another day.
Yeah, absolutely. So yeah, he'd be off scouting. I think so. You've got an era of change, and that does translate onto the pitch as well, because the first thing McGuinness wants to do is make big statements to sort of stamp out any idea that he's not in charge. And that the first major change really is, I say major change, the first major statement he makes after a couple of games. We'll talk about the permanent exiling of a player in a moment, but there was a very temporary one because he dropped Bobby Charlton and Dennis Law. And
yes,
it was so, I mean, we'll talk about the individual players who came in as well, but this was a statement, Paddy. I mean, why do you think that Wilf felt that he had to do this at this moment in time, to drop both of these players, considering how high profile they were?
Well, it was felt that I mean, you could, if you were to become a pseudo-psychiatrist, I'm sure you could try and sort of work out some, right, you know, you were better than me, and now I'm going to show you. But that's just simply doesn't ring true when you know Wilf's character. It was, I mean, he wasn't wrong. It was an aging team. The team had peaked even before in the estimation of John Aston Jr., who was a member of it. The team had peaked even before they won the European Cup. And so to continue, you know, just to go straight in and carry out major surgery on it, now probably a year on from the seeds of the decline, was the right thing to do. It's just that Wilf wasn't the right man to do it, because he'd been their brother.
Yeah,
you know, he'd been a brother to Charlton, and Charlton especially, and to Law as well. So he just wasn't. With the wisdom of hindsight, he just wasn't the man to do it. But he was doing the right thing, and it another reason that he wasn't the right man to do it was that Matt, who still felt he owed those great players for the combination of his sort of redemptive triumph in the European Cup 10 years after Munich, he felt that he owed him them a debt that went beyond football, and even though Lowe didn't play in the final, but he was always there to comfort them, you know, like the, you know, the divisive parent who's always there to pick up the children after they've been scolded by the parent who's actually doing a parent's job.
Yeah, absolutely right with that. That was kind of like Busby's role for this season, but
yes,
where, as far as McGuinness is concerned, you're quite right that, and even when we did the film Too Good to Go Down, which you were part of, they opened the clip, chose a really good clip to open the film, and it was Bobby Charlton talking a few years after, and he was saying that, you know, the changes could have been made before the European Cup, and he could have been part of that change as well. I think he was probably selling himself short because he still had a contribution, but the point he was making was valid in this. But there's another great quote, which Tommy Docherty would later say as well, and this was further down the line, but it still rang true in the summer of 1969. There's no one of the biggest problems in football is a senior player coming to the end, because they
couldn't agree with you more. It's unmanageable. Ask the ghost of Brian Clough after his Leeds experience. You know, you know, they will probably win because people all in power around the club are still feel a debt to those great players. You know, and so. Yes, it was the impossible job, to borrow a phrase used in a different context, but that was the way it was, and meanwhile still there was Matt Busby. I mean, we talk about his job being to be there for the older players, and certainly that's true, but he remained general manager in more than name. He did the transfers as one of the big money incomers that we're going to discuss in this program was to find out.
Yeah, so we'll get onto that. Obviously, Busby will not call it interference, but it was kind of like advice to McGuinness. I wouldn't have dropped Charlton and Lowe, and Charlton and Lowe were back in for the next game. One player who wasn't able to survive that kind of grace from Busby was Bill Foulkes. Three games into the season, Southampton come to Old Trafford. They win 4-1. It's a game that's really defined by Ron Davies scoring four times, bullying Bill Foulkes in a manner that he'd never been accustomed to before. And his career was creeping into its 18th season, just three games old. That took his total to 688 appearances and 9 goals. I mean, you all want, and we talked about the curse of the senior player who doesn't know he's coming to the end. You all want a glorious career to have such a strong flourish. Or even a great fight against a great opponent. But sadly for Bill, that wasn't to be. So this was the sort of epitaph of his career, losing to Southampton at home and conceding 4 goals to Ron Davies. He moved into the coaching staff. He would eventually move into a kind of coaching role where he'd be looking after the reserve team. But as we'll find out in this season as well, his first migration into that kind of area was to work as a sort of a fitness coach, which very much screamed jobs for the boys. We'll just make something for Bill. So, and Bill was a fitness fanatic, so it seemed like.
Yeah. Well, he was 37 by now, and he, you know, just dropped out of the first team. So, that was a testament to his fitness. Also a reflection. he was a very fit lad. I mean, yes, he was a centre half, but he also played fullback, and so he'd done a lot of running. So it was a good choice as fitness coach.
Cool. So he needed to be replaced. There was Paul Edwards in the reserve team. He came up and he was playing first of all at right back, and then he moved into the centre half position. But they wanted to bring in someone from the outside, and they did. You alluded to this name earlier. We've talked about him in previous episodes. Let's get on to the subject of Ian Ewer.
Yes, indeed. Now, Ian Ewer, I think we mentioned in the last episode a punch-up between Dennis Law and Ian Ewer. I think it was at Old Trafford. I think both were sent off. But it was a proper punch-up. And it's there's a lot of evidence that Busby took a look at that and said, yes, that's our new Bill Foulkes. The man, you know, is not going to put up with anything. He's big and he's aggressive with it. And this was Ian Ewer. And eventually, if Busby does institute with McGuinness's acquiescence, the signing of Ian Ewer from Arsenal. Now, I remember Ian Ewer from Dundee, the club I supported from boyhood. And he was part of our team, which won the league, the Scottish League in 1961-62, and then went on to reach the European Cup semi-finals the following year, 62-63. And Ian's reputation was not as a bruiser, even though he looked physically imposing with his great thighs and his, I think, certainly in those days, a blonde crew cut. He's still around, by the way, and I like to think he's a friend of mine, and we keep in touch from time to time. But he, was a footballing centre half. But when he went to England, Bertie Mee at Arsenal and then Matt saw him as somebody who could impose his will physically on centre forwards like Ron Davies or anybody else who fancied a bit. So that's fair enough. Lots of players think they're one kind of player and are bought for another. Dennis thought he was a midfielder, thought he was Brian Robson. And yet he became one of the greatest strikers the British game and indeed the European game, in my opinion, has ever seen. So, yeah, you can play a guy somewhat away from his nature. Ian Ewer was completely miscast, I think, as a bruiser. And he came in, moreover, when he came to Old Trafford, he wasn't fit for purpose. He wasn't fit. He had such bad knee problems relating from his time at Arsenal that, as he told me, he was taking a kind of pill to ease the pain for the 90 minutes of the Saturday afternoon that was later ruled illegal for consumption by racehorses, let alone human beings. So he was not in a good way, as was proved after he, you know, we're jumping ahead, but after he left United, where he, you know, because of his injuries, he just made a negative impression, I would say, on the support. He went to St Mirren, which you would think was quite a step downwards, so he'd be all right there. Only lasted about half a dozen games at St Mirren, and that was the end of his career. So it was a real blunder by Busby to sign him, to sign a crock, basically. And Ian remembered the I can't remember which of the United backroom staff, maybe Jack Crompton, he sort of flexed each knee a little bit and said, fine, okay, that's your fitness test over. And he signed. So it was, yeah, very, very ill-fated move. However, lest it be forgotten, he returned. Ian came into the team instead of Paul Edwards, who was 21, and they'd been struggling. And Matt and Wilf asked Matt, what team would you pick? They'd been beaten 3-0 at Everton on a Tuesday. And Wilf went to Matt and said, what team would you pick for Saturday? And Busby gave him a team and he picked it. Charlton and Law returned for John Aston and Don Givens, who no doubt will come on to during this episode. And Ewer came in instead of Paul Edwards. United drew 0-0 at Wolves. And they went on to complete an unbeaten 10-match run, which, considering the form they'd been in, was a huge improvement. So it is fair to say that Ewer, when he first came in, did help to steady the McGuinness ship for at least that 10-match period.
Yeah, they started really poorly. They no win in the first six games, 3 losses, just 3 goals scored as well. And obviously that embarrassing loss at home to Southampton, but also two losses to Everton. Both came in early in the season, and Everton were a brilliant side, champions elect, but still a terrible start for United nonetheless. In the early autumn, with the defence stabilised, Best turned it on. His form was great, 10 goals in 10 games. But opponents were now beginning to discover that with the other players ageing or not fit, and therefore the replacement's not good enough to play, it was a lot easier to stop George if they could put two men on him. George would become frustrated with this and began to indulge in his private life a little bit more, which meant arriving late for training and stuff like that, sometimes not turning up for training at all. So the post started effectively ruled United out of any serious challenge for the league, but they did well in the Cups. In the League Cup, they get to the semi-final before Christmas. The second leg against Manchester City, United are eliminated, drawing at Old Trafford. George is involved in an altercation with the referee, Jack Taylor. He knocks the ball out of his hands and he's banned for 4 weeks. He's back in time to face Northampton in the FA Cup. And Paddy, this is one of the seminal games of football of George Best's career. Because, yes, Northampton, a lower league opponent, but United go there. They win 8-2. George Best scores 6 of those goals.
Yep.
Ken Jones of the Mirror describes the performance in this way. He says, Best destroyed them as completely as one man can destroy others without inflicting physical damage. It was an absolute masterclass of a performance, wasn't it?
Yes, it was on a muddy pitch. I was going to say, as I recall, but I stress that I recall this from television. I wasn't actually there, but the photograph that's on our screens, for those who have screens at the moment, shows that the pitch was indeed muddy, and that George looks almost as if he's wearing an all dark strip. In fact, he's got white shorts on and white socks. But he doesn't have white socks on. Sorry, I withdraw that appalling error. And scoring one of his goals, surrounded by distraught Northampton players. But yes, it was a memorable performance. People even remember the name of the Northampton goalkeeper, Kim Book. Yeah. Such was, even the supporting cast won Oscars for that performance.
Yeah, great. Some of the goals, you watch a player, obviously had a lot to prove in the timeout, incidentally. So he's out for four matches, which I think it was 6 weeks that he eventually spent on the sidelines. Bill Foulkes took him to a gym in his new role as fitness coach and got Best ready and firing, obviously determined to prove something. We're in the days of United not really doing well in the FA Cup, and like George Best in particular, with his fondness for Wembley, was desperate to get there. They almost did. They came up against Leeds in the semi-final of the FA Cup. Leeds, a very, very physical side. It was a very, very physical game, but United, again, their own worst enemies, because ahead of the game goes to two replays, effectively. Ahead of the first replay, there is, I think it's at Villa Park. United are staying in a hotel in Birmingham. George Best, in preparation for the game, sees a nice woman in the reception area and decides to take her up to his room. This is sort of played out like a cat and mouse game where everyone's trying to deny it. Other people don't want Best to be caught because he's so integral to United's chances. McGuinness finds out, and his initial intention, Paddy, is to drop George from the game because he wants to make a... Well, he's basically a comment on team discipline, but he's overruled again.
Yes. Yes, well, by now George was drinking heavily as well. I mean, the womanizing on that occasion was... upset his teammates. It was just considered too much of a mickey take, And he did have a very, very poor game. The Leeds players were aware of what had happened as well. And he had a poor game. And I suppose when you look at all the things that were wrong, the backbiting, the unhappiness of senior players,
Picture the scene. All of your mates around, you've got your McNugget share boxes ready to go. Partner this with your team playing champagne football. Perfect. Order McDelivery now on the McDonald's app. There's nothing quite like a McDelivery. At participating restaurants, 18 plus, serving times, delivery fee and terms apply. See mcdonalds.com.
It was remarkable that Wilf oversaw a rise over the season of three league places, plus those semi-finals. I mean, under Matt, in Matt's last season, they'd fallen in the quarters, I think. So, you know, it wasn't wholly a disaster, although it was very, very difficult all around.
Yeah, Leeds overcome United after a second replay.
Yeah.
Score late on. United, like you said, the narrow failures in two semi-finals. McGuinness, it is progress from the previous season. And if you're looking at it in isolation, you would say, on results, or at least like the statement at the end of the season where United compared to where they were, you've got a case to say that McGuinness has actually done quite well from what had happened before. But we're looking at the bigger picture and what he's inherited and the mess which is in there. And there was nothing really completely convincing, because then the players had this extra stick to beat McGuinness with. Well, you've not actually got to the final, which is quite unfair considering United hadn't been to an FA Cup final since 63. They'd never been to a League Cup final. It's incumbent on them to raise the game. And obviously Best's wayward attitude had a massive impact on, and really on both semi-finals, because he was his discipline in the League Cup and then ill discipline before the game against Leeds. So, I mean, having done so well in previous big games, perhaps Best's attitude costing them somewhat this season. United play in this terrible idea of a third place playoff in the FA Cup. So they actually finished third in the FA Cup after beating Watford.
I'd forgotten all about that.
Yeah. Well, it's up there with the Watney Cup, isn't it?
Absolutely ridiculous. It's it would be like in the Olympics not giving the beaten semi-finalists a bronze each.
Yeah,
ridiculous. Third place playoffs are my pet hate. I absolutely detest them.
Yeah, I don't think we should lose this. The players don't want to be part of it. They didn't want to be part of it. Nobody. I mean, there was a famous story about Alex Stepney wanted to stay behind because the season was going nowhere. At the end, this was another clash with McGuinness. Stepney, knowing that the season was petering out and not going anywhere, knowing that Rimmer was McGuinness's favourite anyway, even though Stepney had mostly been first choice.
Yeah.
After the game against Watford, which was held down, I think it was Highbury. United win, but Stepney says to McGuinness, can I stay back for the end, for a few days? It doesn't really matter where we're going in the league. McGuinness says no. Stepney goes to the boss. He says, I'll ask the boss then. And Stepney, to be fair, whenever I've talked to him, I'm sure that you have talked to him about this, Stepney regrets doing that because he felt that he contributed to the undermining of McGuinness, which at least shows that there's some responsibility in that squad.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yes, there was. Well, of course, Stepney is a bit of a special bloke. He's a rare human being, actually. He's a really fine man. And it's greatly to his credit that in reviewing it, I mean, a lot of footballers, even really good ones, review their own careers with an uncritical eye.
Yeah.
Not Stepney. So it's good to hear that he said that, even though he will have felt very justified at being usurped, while his form didn't appear to be deteriorating.
No, absolutely not. There's one thing to be said. In a team that had a lot of instability, and it's something we'll talk about in forthcoming seasons, because Stepney was such it became like an obvious target, like, oh, we'll replace the goalkeeper, but it wasn't that simple. And what you're actually sacrificing by that kind of target is losing the stability that Stepney gave to the team. So whenever he was taken out, he was notable by his absence, basically. So when he came back in, even though it didn't seem to be having a profound difference after sort of 10 or 11 games, it's when you him out again that you would realise, oh my God, he's actually such a calming influence on that back line. Yeah. That you don't want to be making that change hasty. But that, I mean, this is something that McGuinness thought about in 1969-70, in 68-69 when he first got the job, because he was putting Rimmer in straight away. But this carried on for 10 years, and a complete undervalue of Stepney really is on what he brought to the side. So just the start of that. Anyway, let's get through to the squad statistics. Like Paddy said, United finished in eighth and semi-finals in both cups. So the squad statistics, Stepney was the first choice goalkeeper this season. I'll put up the tactics on the screen while I'm going through the goalkeepers. So we see Francis the first choice right back. Edwards, more or less, they're eking out David Sadler, but Sadler as well, mostly playing. I put Edwards in there just to notify the fact they played 28 games, but Sadler did, as I'll come on to, play 57. So he really should have been in that one. I just wanted to indicate that that Edwards had been given a run in the side, but I'll be coming on to it in due course. And you'll see
Interesting, actually, when you look, two of those names leap out. Francis Burns, of course, very unlucky in his career so far, largely because of injury. Both he and John Fitzpatrick, who still played a lot of games in midfield, as your tactics board reveals, both of them were suffering from injury. It wasn't just Dennis who was suffering appallingly. He was cortisone injection before every game. Just as well they didn't give him Ian Ewer's Arsenal pills, wasn't it? And but Burns, Fitzpatrick and Best suffered from injury during the season. And Dennis was later to reflect that, yes, they had a lot of fun in those days, but my goodness, the medical backup for players today is something, is the thing he would like most of all, looking back on his own career. But there we go. Sorry to interrupt, Wayne. Let's
You've got Willie
Morgan, Willie Morgan and Tony Dunn, you know, what marvellous servants to the club. They're still there, still providing a little bit of something to lean on, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. Their consistency is much like Stepney's, quite undervalued in where it comes in all day. You know, it could have been even worse if they weren't reliable. But you see the team there, it's like five or six changes from the European Cup already, and we're only 2 years removed from it. So it tells you a lot about, although a lot of those players like Styles, like Lowe, they are still at the club, like Aston, they're still at the club. We'll get through to the team.
Oh, sorry, I missed out Styles. And you know, Styles was a croc by now.
Yeah.
As well, you know, knee problems.
Stepney, first choice, 54 games in all competitions this season. Yeah. And 37 in the league. Jimmy Rimmer makes 5 league appearances.
Yeah.
We'll get on to the defence. Shea Brennan makes 10 appearances in all competitions. 11, one of those a substitute appearance, 9 of those in the league. Francis Burns, now the first choice right back, 42 appearances in all competitions, 3 goals, 32 in the league. Tony Dunn, 33 appearances in the league, 48 in all competitions without a goal. Paul Edwards, as we previously discussed, a local lad, made his debut right at the start of the season, broke through, like I said, as a right back. But then would establish himself as a centre-back once really it's associated with Sadler's, I'd say, demise from the side as well as anything. But he scored 1 goal for the club. That came this season. It was actually in the failed League Cup semi-final. It was an absolute blockbuster of a long-range shot, but he was unable to sort of match that. And obviously because at that time, you've got Burns, who was the dominant right back. Edwards was more or less seen as a squad option until next season, when he would really be given more of a starting role. 28 appearances, though, for Paul this season. Bill Foulkes and Steve James reduced to just 3 appearances each. 3 of Foulkes, all of them in the league. 2 for James in the league. David Sadler, as I previously mentioned, 57 appearances in all competitions, 3 goals, 40 appearances and 2 goals in the league. Brings us to Ian Ewer and that wonderful head of blonde hair. 48 appearances despite the knee problem. A single goal for United this season. 34 in the league. He's mentioned as Wolf McGuinness's only signing, of course, as Paddy mentioned. It's very much a Matt Busby signing. He was pictured with Busby and Murphy. There is, you know, it couldn't have been more of a Busby signing. Of course, he was a Dundee hero. We've got to revisit that of title-winning fame. And while we're mentioning his stature in the game, he went to Arsenal for a fee that was a world record fee for a centre-half, and he did that again when he moved to United. So it is a reminder of how highly thought of he was in the game, but he was suffering from that chronic knee injury that he got picked up pretty early on at Arsenal. He actually said of George Best, and this is in, he will have definitely said this to you, and then no, he said it elsewhere as well, he should have been dealt with and I would have got rid of him, which gives you an idea of how Best was perceived from the outside.
Yes, absolutely. He went through, Ewer went through the injury problems, and he said, but even George Best should have gone. It would have caused a sensation. But by the time I got there, he was drinking heavily 3 or 4 nights a week. He was a great player and the nicest guy, but he'd become a bad influence on the club. And yet, he was kind of holding the club up at the same time. So this was the dilemma that any manager of Manchester United would have faced at that time and for a few years after.
Yeah, absolutely. John Aston, 30 appearances in all competitions.
Really? As many as that? That's good.
Yeah. 22 in the league, 1 substitute appearance. Bobby Charlton, 14 goals in 57 games, another outstanding return. Yeah. 12 goals in 40 in the league. Paddy Creran reduced to just 25 appearances in the league, 36 in all competitions, and a single goal.
Fitzpatrick would have taken over from him. Yeah.
Well, Fitzpatrick, due to his own knee injuries, 26 appearances and 3 goals, but he was very much seen as the successor to Creran or even to Styles, considering partnered each other for much of the season. Fitzpatrick, 20 goals, 20 appearances in the league, 20 goals. He would have been happy with that, wouldn't he? 20 appearances in the league and 3 goals. Willie Morgan on the right, a really good return from him for goals because he wasn't renowned as a great goal scorer, but 9 goals in 49 games, 7 in 35 in the league. George Best, top goal scorer, 23 goals in 53 games.
Wow.
15 in 37 in the league, but obviously 6 of those in the overall total accounted for by Ken Buck at Northampton picking the ball out of the net. The backup wingers, Jimmy Ryan, a single substitute appearance this season, which shows you how reliable really Morgan was, but also even though Best was struggling, 53 games was still a good return for him, even though he was getting a flogging every time he stepped onto the pitch. The other backup in the midfield area would have been Carlos Autore, a forward in earlier days, but moving back into midfield now,
playing
on those wide areas. 3 goals in 29 appearances for him this season, 2 in 17 in the league. And Nobby Styles made just 13 appearances this season, 8 of those in the league. It brings us on to the forward line, Alan Gowling. We mentioned him in a previous episode as well, one of the smartest United players of all time. 8 appearances and 3 goals in all competitions, 7 appearances in the league and 3 goals there. Don Givens, we spoke about him earlier on in the episode, another youth product given a chance right at the start of the season. He makes 9 appearances and scores a single goal. 4 of those appearances are starts in the league, 8 appearances in the league in total, because he makes 4 substitute appearances as well. He was the player who was given Bobby Charlton's number 9 shirt when he was dropped to Everton, when Charlton was dropped to Everton. But he only made these appearances for the club in this single season, which was a shame for him because he was eventually transferred to Luton Town, but really did show his class in the Republic of Ireland national team and most notably for QPR in a magnificent QPR team. So, just 1 goal in 9 appearances, but as it turned out, a successful academy product from United elsewhere. People talk about Johnny Giles as one of the rare examples of a player who left United and went on to much bigger, better things. But Don Givens, you could definitely give that description to as well. Often fairly decried, unfairly decried as a big failure at United. He's just a victim of this transition at the moment. He's not Bobby Charlton. He's not Dennis Lowe, who is. But he's one of the first ones who suffers with that. And Dennis Lowe himself, you mentioned earlier, 16 games this season, he's reduced to just 11 in the league, 2 goals in the league, 3 in all competitions, which leaves really the spot for Brian Kidd, who had been desperate for first team football. And as we'll talk about in subsequent episodes, would become desperate again. He sort of benefited from this transition. Like, Charlton plays a few games in the front line this season. Obviously, Lowe struggled with it, but becomes the most reliable striker. Scores 20 goals in 49 games in all competitions, 12 in the league. So a really good return for Kidd, and really showing that he deserves his opportunity and that he's worthy of it as well. But unfortunately for him, as we'll come to discuss in future episodes, for whatever reason, because he's not a Dennis Lowe or Bobby Charlton, that kind of consistency underappreciated what he did bring to the side. Let's go through the United review. Look, we have a change. There's no more handshake. A very 70s design for the new decade. It's basically 3 large circles, one with an image of one of the previous games, one with the name of the program, United Review, and another with the name of the opposition in there. Very basic.
It's a nice picture. Lovely picture, though, isn't it?
Oh, yeah, and it gives the one thing that the design of the program does do is presents a bigger opportunity for a nice spread like that as well. It also presents this, which is a slight deviation from the way that teams were listed. Now, you'll remember from previous episodes, and me and Paddy have gone back and forth on this, particularly in the first 5 episodes, was the way that teams were laid out, and they'd be the 2-3-5 formation. And Paddy was quite right in saying it should be a 3-2-5, and then really, over time, 3-2-2-3, which the Hungarians embarrassed when they inverted that at Wembley. Yeah. And now it's just making life easier for the program makers. They're just going 1-11. And listing the team because they don't want to get caught into any positional shenanigans. They don't want to be caught out with that.
It's an interesting program. If you can keep that up on the screen that those of us who have screens can see, the team lists are surrounded by adverts, of course. Naturally, one for the Manchester Evening News, but British Rail have decided to offer a ticket to Newcastle for United fans from Victoria Station, and that costs £2.25 return, which is not bad. But I suppose actually, if you take off inflation, it's just about the same as it would be now. but the match program, the team sheet on our sheet. I'm glad you put up for the one for the Old Trafford derby, Manchester United, Manchester City. Because a point that we need to make, however little you may like it, Wayne, is that Manchester United were the second best team in Manchester at this stage. Manchester City had embraced the new football to the extent that they had really good coaching from Malcolm Allison under the careful a knowledgeable eye of Joe Mercer. Mercer and Allison at that stage, though they were to have a schism, were as close as Busby and McGuinness were separate. And they'd produced a very, very good team because in this season, when United had been sort of nearly men in cups, City had won the League Cup after beating United in the semis, and the Cup Winners' Cup secured after victory over Górnik of Poland in Vienna. And the league was won by Everton under Harry Kattrick. But it's worth dwelling on that Manchester City team because Joe Corrigan was in goal, Tony Book, Doyle Booth, Oakes. So they were very much still a big club. It had the Somerby Bell Lee Neil Young and so on. So they had, they're a very, very good team, very exciting team. And this just simply added to United's problems that they, you know, they had no bragging rights in their own backyard.
Yeah, absolutely. United's colours this season, red, white and red socks, all white away kit, and the blue kit, which was the third kit, was blue, white and blue. The average attendance back down again to 51,152, but they did have highs of 63,000 against Manchester City and Middlesbrough City in the League Cup, as we mentioned. Best top scorer, as we've already mentioned there. The key results this season, you would say the semi-finals, City and Leeds, they're obvious places to start because they had such an influence in what would eventually be dogged against McGuinness. Yes. What would stand against him. You would look at a season like this, you would look at the results and say, well, United won 4-1 at Anfield, and I'm pretty sure I'm safe in saying they haven't won as handsomely there since that. But they also lost 4-1 to Southampton at home, and I think the 4-1 loss against Southampton and
the Ron Davies.
Yeah, the Ron Davies, the Bill Foulkes thing, the fact that it was there, followed by, you know, these players being dropped and everything like that. It was very much a case of that defeat, that result really did was indicative of the McGuinness era, even though it happened so early on in it. You mentioned the other trophy winners. Chelsea, of course, also won the FA Cup. Famously, a trophy was seen at Old Trafford. It was just won by Chelsea. And Dave Sexton would win a trophy at Old Trafford, but it just before Chelsea because the replay was held at Old Trafford. We're talking about Dundee's 8 years earlier in the episode, but it was a great year for Scottish football, this one. 1970, went to the World Cup. Celtic got to the European Cup final, defeated by Feyenoord there. And did Scotland get to that Summers World Cup? I'm thinking 1974, but now I'm not sure about 1970. But that Summers World Cup is remembered very fondly, of course, because it was crowned with one of the seminal finals, wasn't it? Brazil against Italy and Carlos.
It was the best international. It's only my opinion, but Brazil produced the best international football team of all time.
Yeah.
In 1970, so yeah, that was the team of Pelé, Jairzinho, Gerson. So the crossbar was very, very high at that time. And I think in 1970, you mentioned Scotland. Did you mention Celtic getting to the European Cup final?
They were defeated by Feyenoord in the final.
Feyenoord, that's right. Yeah. So, yes, it was. Scottish football was still, it's fair to say, you know, you just need to look at the United team that year to see the sprinkling of, you know, Burns, Fitzpatrick, Law, who have I left out? You know, Scots all over the place, you know. So, yes, still fond days for a Scotland supporter like me to look back on, yeah.
And hopefully fond days for United fans to look forward to in the next episode because, you know, after that progress, which is definite, we can say eighth place in the league and two semi-finals, surely Wolf McGuinness will do even better next time round. We will be back. Check that out. So we'll see how it goes for sure. If you're watching the video, please give it a like and subscribe. Join in the conversation in the comment section. If you're listening to the audio podcast, please be sure to subscribe and subscribe even and give us a review on the platform you're listening on. We will be back next time to see how the Wilf McGuinness era continues.
Away days are great, but there's nothing quite like playing at home. The same goes for McDonald's. Maximize your home ground advantage with McDelivery. Order now on the McDonald's app. At participating restaurants, 18 plus serving times, delivery fee and terms apply. See mcdonalds.com.
This podcast is proud to be part of the TalkSport Fan Network.
TalkSport. Powered by fans.